in researching what I was going to talk about this week on the Parsha, I was looking inside of a sefer, inside of a book, which brings down the drushes, the speeches that Rav Yaakov Galinsky gave. There were two different points that I wanted to look up. In any event, I came across a piece that caught my eye. I had no intention of speaking about it, but then something interesting happened to me, which I would like to share. He discusses, at the beginning of the Parsha, Rashi points out to us that the Parsha is Sasum, which means that there's no break between the beginning of this week's Parsha and the end of last week's Parsha. And Rashi explains that it was basically, when Yaakov Avinu died, it was the process of the Shibud, the enslavery, the enslavement in Mitzrayim, in Egypt, really beginning to happen. That was when the first beginnings of what was going to happen in next week's Parsha and afterwards. So he said that one time he was in a cab, and the cab driver said, "Do you mind if I ask you a question, Rabbi?" And he said, "Sure, go ahead, ask me a question." And he said, "Listen, I work very hard, long hours. My wife also, she works. And we don't manage to finish off the month. We don't even manage to make ends meet. And yet you people," probably referring to Haredi Jews in general, he said, "you people have very large families, a lot of mouths to feed, and somehow you live. How does that work?" So Rav Yaakov Galinsky said to him, "It's a Rashi in this week's Parsha. It's a Rashi in the Torah." And he said, "Really? The Rashi talks about my situation?" And he said, "No, he talks about us." And he said, "This Rashi that we just mentioned, that this week's Parsha starts off Sasum. Now Sasum literally means closed. But it's also a way of expressing something that is very difficult to understand. Something that is, it's closed to our understanding. And it says in the Parsha, Vayichi Yaakov Be'eretz Mitzrayim, Yaakov was living, he lived in the land of Mitzrayim, in the land of Egypt." So if Yaakov Galinsky asks rhetorically, how is it possible to live in Mitzrayim? How is it possible for the Jews to make it, so to speak, in Egypt? We don't know. But they did! That was his answer. And then he told the cab driver a story. He said that there was someone who was studying in Kollel. He had been in yeshiva in Kollel for many, many years. And as time went on and his family grew, the financial situation was getting tighter and tighter. They started marrying off children. Things got to the point where he felt that it was impossible. And he went to Rav Shach. He went to Rav Shach and he asked Rav Shach if perhaps maybe he should take an opportunity to study bookkeeping so that he'll be able to make a decent parnasa. And he'll work half the day, learn half the day, and that way be able to provide for his family. And he mentioned for good measure that not only was the finances becoming an issue, but the atmosphere at home in general was becoming tense. Things between him and his wife were starting to get a little bit difficult. Rav Shach answered him in a very terse manner. He said, "I don't hold of such a thing." Now, I'm just going to pause from Rav Yaakov Galinsky's story for a moment to mention that, as is well known, there are varying views within the sages of Israel throughout many generations regarding the fundamental topic of trusting in Hashem versus putting forth your own effort, which naturally spills over into the topic of at what point or to what extent can a person devote himself solely to spiritual pursuit and not necessarily put himself forth in the realm of trying to make a livelihood and things like that, etc. And of course there are differences of opinion. This was Rav Shach. This is what he told this person. So, this individual accepted what Rav Shach said and he went along with his life, but things were getting increasingly more and more difficult this time. When he went back to Rav Shach sometime later and he asked him again, and he said, "You know, things are really, really difficult." And Rav Shach said to him, "Listen, I understand your situation, but I don't hold of it." So then the person pressed a little bit, and he said, "Is it forbidden? Am I not allowed to leave full-time learning in order to learn a profession?" So Rav Shach said, "Chas v'shalom, it's not aser. I'm not saying that it's aser. I'm not saying that it's forbidden. But if you're asking me what I personally think about it, I'm telling you that I personally don't hold of it." So this individual left, and he decided, if Rav Shach told me that it's not forbidden, and I really don't see any way out, so he decided to go ahead with it. and he learned bookkeeping, and he was very good at it, and he got his degree, and he got a job, and he was making very decent money, and he was learning in the morning, and as much other time as he could, and he was making decent money. But all of a sudden, out of nowhere, were popping up all types of unforeseen expenses. Things in his home were breaking and needed repair. There were needs to visit doctors much more, and all types of other expenses, to the extent that their financial situation actually did not get any better. And he couldn't understand what was going on. So he sat down to take an accounting, to take stock of his life, and he was wondering to himself, what could possibly be the reason behind this? And the conclusion that he came to is that since he disregarded Rav Shach's opinion, he felt that that must be what was working against him. So he went to Rav Shach for a third time. And he, kind of quaking in his boots, begged Rav Shach for forgiveness. And he said, I'm so sorry. And he said, I'm fearful that the kpeda, that you're being upset about the fact that I didn't listen to you, is negatively affecting me. So Rav Shach took his hand warmly and very lovingly said to him, No, chas v'shalom, I wasn't upset at you at all that you didn't listen to me. He said, listen, I want to explain it to you. I told you already, I don't think that what you did is asr to do. I didn't say it's forbidden. But you asked me what I personally feel, and I feel, I told you that it's not something that I hold of. And I'll explain to you why. The life of a ben Torah, the life of someone who's fully immersed in spiritual pursuit of studying Torah full time, is a life which is conducted by heavenly providence in a way which is totally different from the regular way that providence runs the world. Normally, there's an approach that goes according to the rules of nature, the laws of nature. But a ben Torah, someone who's fully immersed in learning Torah, gets a special, almost supernatural type of divine providence. In the sense that the sages say, you eat a little bit and it gets blessed inside of your insides and it fills you up anyway. And he said, that's why I told you that I don't hold of it. Because the moment a person leaves the cocoon of full immersion in Torah and spiritual pursuit, even if he's spending a lot of time learning Torah, and even if he makes sure to have set times to learn, he won't necessarily have that same miraculous type of divine providence. And of course, as we know, our world is a world that is chock full of all types of things that can happen to a person. So that was the end of that story. Now, after I read that piece, which I found fascinating, both stories I found fascinating, both the interchange with the cab driver and the story with Rav Shach, I couldn't help but wonder to myself, I mean, first off, when I read the story, even though on a personal level I identify more with the approach that says that you're not really supposed to rely on miracles, and if things are such that it seems like there's no way out, then you really do have to put forth the effort, but I felt that it deepened my appreciation for that approach that was espoused by Rav Shach, despite the fact that I didn't necessarily personally fully identify it. But intellectually, I couldn't help but wonder to myself, but wait a minute, what about all the times that we find in the Gemara, in the Talmud, that it describes different great sages that had jobs? Hillel had a job, and Rabbi Yehoshua had a job, and many others. Okay, so I thought about it for a moment or two, and then I just kind of left it in my mind as a question. Then I wanted to see if there was a piece from Rav Yaakov Galinsky on the other point in the parsha that I was wondering about, perhaps thinking about speaking about today. So I flipped towards the end of the parsha, and the piece that I opened up to read as follows. Please bear with me. Rav Yaakov Galinsky told another story. He was a magid, he was a darshan, so he tells many stories. He's not alive anymore, but he used to tell many stories. He told the following story. He was in America, making his rounds, collecting money for various Torah institutions of higher learning. And he had a driver who was very knowledgeable about all the different wealthy people that he was driving him to. And he told him, you know, this person that we're going to now, he's a chassid of this and this Rebbe. So it would not be a bad idea if you mention a thought, an idea from that Rebbe. And then when they went to a different one, he said, this one is a student of such and such Rosh Yeshiva. If you can mention an idea from that Rosh Yeshiva's Sefer, his book that he published, that would be a great way. And then he said, you know, another person, he loves it if you'll tell him an incisive line of inquiry in the Daf Yomi. And then he went to another person and said, this guy loves hearing a vort on the Parsha, and so on and so forth. And Rav Yaakov Galinsky tells that every single piece of advice was worth its weight in gold, quite literally. As they were going along their way, he said to the driver, what about such and such wealthy person? How about if we go to him? So the driver told him a piece of Lashon Hara, which was for a constructive purpose, and he said, listen, that particular individual, he does not give a dime to Torah institutions. He said, the guy is apparently an expert in Pirkei Avos, and he will quote you every single statement that talks about making, you know, needing to put forth effort to make a living. So Yaakov Galinsky said, all right, you know what, why not? Let's give it a try anyway, but on two conditions. He said, I want you to come inside with me. The driver looks at him with this bewildered look in his eyes, as if to say, what exactly do you want me to do there? I don't remember the second condition. In any event, they got there. The wealthy individual was very gracious. He brought them into his office or his home, whatever it was. And he heard out Rav Yaakov Galinsky, the institutions that he's collecting for, very respectfully. And he showed a lot of interest, displayed and demonstrated interest for the different things that he was talking about. However, when Rav Yaakov Galinsky finished, this wealthy individual said, listen, for me, it's a matter of principle. I personally hold that he who works will have what to eat, and he who doesn't work, so how will he have what to eat? And he said, I'm not interested in supporting people who eat the bread of shame, so to speak, who are living off of the chesed of others. And then he went on to his whole, I guess you could say his whole prepared speech. He said, you know, such and such great sage in the Talmud was a blacksmith, and such great, great sage in the Talmud was a weaver, and so on and so forth. And this one was a shoemaker, and the Rambam and the Ramban were doctors, and the Chafetz Chaim would help his wife from time to time run the store, and this one and that one, and a whole litany practically. And he made it clear that this is a matter of principle for him. He's not interested. Rav Yaakov Galinsky hears him out and says, you know what? I'm very happy to hear that you are a man of such principle, because I'm hoping that perhaps you could settle a dispute between me and my driver. The driver looks at him, can't understand what he's talking about. He had no idea that there was any dispute between the two of them. And he says, listen, a lot of people are donating money for the Torah institutions that I'm collecting for. And this driver also, he's not getting paid. He's volunteering because he also wants to do his part. He doesn't have the means to be able to give money, but he wants to be able to do his part, so he drives me around. However, he told me that he wants me to pay for the gasoline because he doesn't want to have to lose money on it. However, my personal feeling, Rav Galinsky continued, is that what am I supposed to do? The people that are donating money are doing it to support Torah, not to buy gasoline. And he said, I don't have any other money besides that. So you're a man of principle. Clearly you see that I'm correct, right? But don't answer right away. I don't want him to think that, you know, you sided with me without giving it any thought. Please give it some proper thought and then tell us what you think. So both the wealthy individual and the driver are both looking at him as if he just fell off the moon. And the wealthy man says, obviously, he is correct. And Rav Yaakov Galinsky says, he's correct? That I should have to pay for the gasoline? Are you sure that's fair? And he said, of course it's fair. Are you kidding? He's a tzaddik for not asking for a percentage or for at least some type of bare minimum salary. But without gasoline, you shouldn't even have to pay for the gasoline. Without gasoline, he won't be able to drive you anywhere. So then Rav Yaakov Galinsky, with a twinkle in his eye, says, you know, I was thinking the same thing. Would you be willing to bring me a Gemara Brachos? And now, this person starts nodding his forehead, wondering where this is going. But he's a gracious host, and he brings a tractate Brachos to Rabbi Galinsky. Rav Galinsky opens it up to a passage that reads as follows. Praiseworthy are you, bold of heart, who work very hard to cling to the Almighty and are distant from charity. It's basically a verse, and the Gemara explains that it's referring to people like Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa, who was a great, great tzaddik, and there's a heavenly voice that comes out and says, the whole world is fed and sustained in the merit of Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa, but my son Hanina, he makes do with one kav measure of caribs from one Friday to the next. Meaning that's what he has for each week. Dirt poor, as we would say. Rav Galinsky then mentioned another Gemara in Chulin that talks about Rabbi Chiya and his children. Rabbi Chiya and his children, says the Gemara, when they came up from Babel to Eretz Yisrael, their merit was so powerful, so great, that no longer did people have to worry about ever getting damaged by lightning or thunder or earthquakes. And one of the things that the Gemara specifically mentions is that their linen would never go bad. Nothing would ever happen bad to their linen. And the Gemara says, wait a minute. Rabbi Chiya himself one time asked his own Rebbe for a piece of advice. What should he do? Because his linen, his flax, got some worms in it. They were infesting it and eating it up and ruining it. So Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, his Rebbe, told him, put it in water, and then when you get around to shechting a bird, slaughter the bird on top of the water so that the blood goes in, and these types of worms, they don't like the blood from a bird, and they'll leave. And the Gemara says, wait a minute. Rabbi Chiya's merit was protecting everybody, including that their linen wouldn't go bad, and his own linen goes bad, and the answer is that his merit was working for everybody else, but not for him. Because that's the way it works. That's what we see. That they're distant from charity. That's what the pasuk is saying. Meaning that their merit, which is helping everybody else, is not even helping them. So Rav Galinsky, probably with an even more powerful twinkle in his eye, turns back to this wealthy individual and says, listen, it's true, you work hard, and you make a lot. But you have to understand that it's in the merit of those that are fully immersed in the spiritual pursuit of studying Torah full time, that is your driver. They're the ones in whose merit you're making and producing what you're able to produce. Now, they're not asking for a percentage, and they're not asking for even a baseline salary, but at least the gasoline, so that they should be able to keep going and be able to help you and the rest of the world, that maybe is worthwhile for you to consider. So this person turns to Rav Galinsky and he says, you have bested me. You have convinced me. And he wrote out a very nice check. And then he said, but I want to ask you a question. If it's true, and I believe that it's true because this person was a fully believing Jew, and if the Gemara says it, he believes it. He said, if it's true that it's in their merit that the whole world is sustained, so then why is it decreed upon them that they have to suffer such poverty? So if Galinsky told him, he said, now that is a fantastic question. And of course, according to his way, he starts answering it with a story. But he says that it's in this week's Parsha in Vayechi. Really, the answer is in this week's Parsha in Vayechi. But he starts off with a story. And he said, the great Baron Rothschild, there were a number of them, the one he's referring to is Shimon Rothschild. He said he lived in Vienna. He said his father, forgot the name of the father, was the one who financed the train that went from Vienna to, I think it was Germany and Poland. In any event, at one point in time, a telegram arrived informing the Rothschilds that there was a major business opportunity that opened up in Poland. There was a whole block of hotels that for whatever reason the owners went bankrupt or something of that nature, and the whole massive property block was available for purchase at a ridiculously low price. Of course, the Rothschilds were very interested in such a business opportunity, and they decided to take it up. There was one problem, though, one glitch, that the owners were only willing to give it for this price, for this ridiculously low price, if all of the money would be paid in cash. In cash, up front, on the spot. That didn't deter them, and they made their plans. Of course, traveling, especially in those days, I mean, in any days, but certainly in those days, with that much cash, was quite dangerous. Now, besides for the Rothschilds and the people in Poland who were going to be the sellers, there was one other person who knew about this. And that person was the person who manned the telegraph. And he was apparently not such a scrupulous individual. And for a fee, quote unquote, he tipped off the mafia in Vienna about what was going on. So they made a whole plan about how they are going to steal this money from Rothschild. They had 10 gangsters. They found out, they knew from the person who manned the telegraph exactly what day and time, when the train that he was going to be taking to, I think he was going to Warsaw. So they found out exactly what time the train and what day, and they put 10, they had 10 gangsters in the first car where all the very super wealthy people travel. And the plan was that 8 of them would make a whole hullabaloo, a whole disturbance in the car, while 2 of them would rob, steal the money from Rothschild, and then they would all get off at the first stop, and then make their getaway in a carriage that would be waiting there. Just to be sure, they had another 3 gangsters in the second car, where, you know, the regular merchants were, and they even had an extra 2 gangsters in the back cabin, where all the poor people were, you know, who sat on the rickety benches and were stuffed in with all their luggage and everything. To their great dismay, after scanning the whole crowd, they noticed that Rothschild was nowhere in sight. Now, the 4th car of the train, in the very, very rear, was where all the animals were stored. There were horses, and there were cows, and there were pigs, and of course there was tons and tons of hay and straw. And as normally happens, there were a number of stowaways over there. So they got to the first stop, and they were hoping maybe Rothschild would get up on that stop. Nothing doing. They go on, they pass the Czechoslovakian border. Finally, they get into Poland, and they give up. The gangsters give up. They alight from the train. They get into a carriage, and they're gone. Finally, the train gets to Warsaw, and amongst the stowaways in the animals' cabin is a person who stands up, and, you know, shaking off the hay was not such a big deal, but the stench that was stuck to him after being there for such a long time was really awful. He takes off his overcoat, and underneath is revealed a very fine suit, and he's got his briefcase, and he's ready to flag down a carriage to take him to a very posh hotel, where he's going to bathe and change and go on with his business. Of course, this is Rothschild. This was his plan of how to avoid any trouble. He gets into the carriage, but lo and behold, it turns out this was not a regular carriage. The gangsters were smarter than we might have thought. And this was a carriage that they had waiting there. They grabbed the briefcase from Rothschild, which of course would be carrying all his money. And at a certain point, they pushed him off the carriage and they made their getaway. No problem. Rothschild is fully composed. Flags down another carriage, gets to his hotel, gets to his room, and there waiting there is his assistant, his accountant, who's got 2 briefcases, one with clothing and one with all the money. So Rav Galinsky turned to this wealthy individual after he told his story, and he said, let me ask you a question. What do you think? How do you think Rothschild felt while he was riding in the animal cabin with the stench and the hay? I mean, just an awful situation. Really just terrible. How do you think he felt? You think he felt awful? Or you think he felt amazing? Because it was so worth it for him to pull off this stunt in order to be able to make sure that the gangsters don't get what they want. He said, it's obvious. The man felt incredible. He felt great. And he told another mashal from the Chafetz Chaim. I don't remember if it was a mashal or an actual real story. I think it actually was a real story that happened. There was a gem merchant who was at a certain, he lived in, I think, in St. Petersburg, and he traveled all the way to Danzig, very distant, for a special market where they were going to be selling precious stones for a good prices, and he was very successful. He got the merchandise that he needed, very good prices, fine. He left himself 300 rubles for his travel, for his travel needs on the way back, so that he should be able to travel with style according to a person of his stature. As he's in his room getting his things together, Someone bursts into the room, looked terrified, closes the door behind him, and he whispers, he said, listen, I'm a diamond merchant, and one of my competitors has just spread a horrible libel about me, and he went to the authorities, and he made up this whole story, and they're about to arrest me and lock me up, and I've got to get out of here. I've got to escape. I have a bag full of diamonds that are absolutely priceless, and I'm willing to sell them to you for a crazy, absolute rock bottom price of 10,000 rubles. Just take it, and I'll take the money, and I'll get out of here. He looks at the diamonds, and he could tell he himself was a gem merchant, so he knew that this was legit, and he knew that they were worth way, way, way more than 10,000 rubles. But what could he do? He only had 300 rubles cash left. So he turns to the guy and he says, I'm sorry, I just don't have that type of cash. And the guy is shaking like a leaf, and he says, all right, 5,000 rubles. And he says, I'm really sorry. You know, I feel for you. I'd love to help you. I just don't have that type of cash. And the guy says, listen, please, I beg of you, do me a favor. 1,000 rubles and it's yours. Take it and go. And he says, listen, I only have 300 rubles. I left myself 300 rubles to be able to get home to St. Petersburg, and that's it. And he said, fine, give me the 300 rubles. I've got to get out of here and take the diamonds. And so it is. He gives him 300 rubles, figures there's no way he can pass up. How's he going to get home? He doesn't know. But there's no way he could pass up on the deal literally of a lifetime that's going to turn him into the one of the wealthiest people, you know, around. So what does he do? He starts walking home. Now, you have to understand, St. Petersburg is exceedingly, exceedingly far from Danzig. It's going to take him quite a while. But he's walking home, says Rav Galinsky. He was dancing all the way home. He knows that he just made the business deal of his whole lifetime. But what? His feet start to hurt. His stomach starts to rumble. He has no choice. He hooks up together with a group of beggars, and he goes together with them. And from town to town, he sticks out his hand, begging just like anybody else. I guess it wasn't possible for him to sell any of his gems along the way. Maybe he didn't want to expose himself or whatever it was. But whatever the case may be, it wasn't possible for him to get any access to liquid funds along the way. And he had to live like a beggar the whole time. He had to sleep on park benches and eat people's, you know, leftovers that they threw in the garbage and so on and so forth. And he just had to suck it up and live like a completely impoverished, you know, downtrodden person the whole way home. And every time he would start to feel down and out, he would go to a corner where nobody could see him, and he would very, very carefully open up his stash of diamonds that he got, and he would look at it, and at that moment, all of his pain and suffering would just totally vanish. So Rav Galinsky concluded by saying to this wealthy individual, he said, you know, B'nai Torah, people that immerse themselves fully in spiritual pursuit, that they fully immerse themselves in the study of Torah, what do they want? What they want is spiritual acquisition. That's what they want. They want to build up their heavenly bank account with more and more and more and more spiritual assets, spiritual properties. Just what? This world is a world of enticement. It's a world of enticement. It's always ready to ensnare a person. It's always ready to ensnare him and to pull him away from that which he really wants. What really is the most precious possessions. As the verses and the sages emphasize over and over again how words of Torah and mitzvos, that's the real treasure, worth far more than all the other treasures of the whole world. In this week's parasha, Rav Galinsky told this individual, it says, Yisachar Chamor Garim. We all know Zvulun and Yisachar, they made a partnership. Zvulun was involved in the business and supporting Yisachar. Yisachar Chamor Garim. Yisachar was like a heavy-boned donkey. Raybeitz Beinamish Besayim. He would just crouch down in between the borders of the cities. He wouldn't take it easy and go into a stall and have a good nap, a good sleep. And then he takes the burden upon himself, but then the pasuk says something very interesting. Vayar menucha kitov. He sees that rest is good. Ve'es ha'aretz kina'im, and that the land is pleasant. Vayet shichmoy lizboil vayin lemasai ved. But he bears his shoulder to bear the burden, and he becomes like a tax worker. And the sages explain what that means is that he bears his shoulder to bear the burden of Torah, of full immersion in Torah, and that he's beholden to the Jewish people to provide them with guidance in halacha and hashkafa, etc. So Rav Galinsky said, the pasuk said though that he saw that rest is good, and that the land is pleasant. So what's going on? He said, the understanding that we get is that, yeah, for sure, Yisachar looks at the world, and he says, it is enjoyable. It is wonderful. You really could enjoy yourself. But he says, but it's nothing compared to what I can get if I fully bear the yoke of Torah. If I fully immerse myself without any distractions, full immersion into spiritual pursuit. Because that's what's going to get me the full thing. And therefore, Senator of Galinsky, that is why the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says that the way of Torah for those that are fully, fully immersed in it, in a way that is, to a great extent, almost beyond comprehension, is pas b'melach tochel. You eat bread with just a little bit of salt. Mayim b'mesura tishta, you drink water in small measure. Ala aretz tishon, you sleep on the ground. You might wind up having to sleep on the ground. V'chayitzar tichya, and you might have to live a life that has a lot of suffering. U'b'tayra ata amel, and you're toiling in Torah. And it says, and if you do this, Ashrecha v'tayv lach. Ashrecha, how fortunate you are in this world. V'tayv lach lo'aylam abba, and how good it will be for you in the next world. In the next world, I understand, said Rav Galinsky, but in this world. And he said, yeah, in this world. Like Rothschild on his way to Warsaw, when he's riding together with the animals and the hay. And like that diamond merchant on his way on foot with the beggars, from Danzig to St. Petersburg. Because that's really what's happening. We're passing through. We're passing through. We're travelers. As the sages put it, Adam holech el beis olamo. A person is traveling, he's walking towards his home of eternity, which is in the next world. We're travelers. And when you're a traveler, and you understand that your spiritual acquisitions, your spiritual assets, your heavenly bank account, which is expanding more and more and more, and every now and then you give a look, yeah, ashrecha b'olam hazeh. That is the pinnacle of the joy that a person can have. And I'll end off with an anecdote about Rav Aaron Cutler. Rav Aaron Cutler was once conducting a parlor meeting, and he mentioned the statement of the sages that says that those that provide monetary support to Torah in this world will merit to know Torah on the level of those that they supported in the next world. They will merit, even if they didn't manage to get there through their own study in this world, in the next world, they will merit the level of the Talmud Chacham. So one of the participants in the meeting said, Rebbe, is it really true? Am I really going to be like the Rosh Yeshiva in the next world? So Rav Aaron Cutler, without missing a beat, says to him, it has to be literally true. This world you don't have. At least you should have the next world. So, whichever particular philosophical outlook a person may personally identify with, I think there's two major points that we can take out over here. Number one is to deepen our appreciation and respect for those that do fully immerse themselves in Torah and fully focus and fully concentrate on spiritual acquisition, on expanding their spiritual assets, their heavenly bank account. That's number one. And number two is for ourselves as well to understand that whatever our station might be in this world, and whatever we might find ourselves doing, to understand that what really makes life worth living, what really makes life valuable, what really infuses us with the sense of joy of being, is our Torah and our mitzvos, our connection with Hashem. Have a wonderful Shabbos.